Hi there, it's Ed here with a short message before we start the pod this week. Did you know that our most informed investors get insights, articles, and investment ideas from Tom, me, and the team sent directly to them via email, and it is completely free. You can join them. Just subscribe at fidelity.co.uk/newsletters. Hello and welcome to the Personal Investor Podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, it's a quarterly investment outlook special where we put your questions to the Outlook's author, Tom Stevenson. The questions this time focused on the sustainability of recent market gains, the impact of elections on either side of the Atlantic, and the best source of income, and much else besides. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. Each quarter, Fidelity publishes its Investment Outlook, a snapshot of the market's landscape that rounds up the issues on the minds of investors. An invaluable part of that is the questions that we invite you to submit to us, and in particular to the Outlook's author, Tom Stevenson. Tom and I have answered some of those questions in a special video that accompanies the Outlook. You can find that, as well as the Outlook itself, at the Markets and Insights section of our website at fidelity.co.uk. The podcast this week takes on even more of those questions, and Tom is here with me to do that. Tom, welcome along. Before we get into the questions, we had absolutely loads of questions, by the way. But before we get into them, can we have a word on the current mood in markets? I actually looked back at the last time we did an outlook back in January and compared some of the questions that we were getting at that time to this. And there does seem to be a bit more optimism in the tone from questioners. Certainly some concern about where markets are headed, but people are looking to, you know, whether these gains can be continued.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a lot more optimism around than there was 3 months ago, certainly 6 months ago. You know, last summer, of course, we had that correction. The market sort of bottomed out in October and has been going up pretty strongly for the last 6 months or so. I think it's taken some of us by surprise the extent to which the rally last autumn has continued into the new year. So I think that explains the optimism. People do extrapolate forward what the recent past. It makes me slightly nervous, and I do find myself feeling like I'm being sort of pulled into this slightly more optimistic frame of mind, which always worries me. But you know, I'm sure we'll come on to the details in it. You know, there are good reasons why the market is going up and good reasons why it might continue to go up.
Hold that thought. Because let's get into the questions. And the very first question addresses exactly that point. And it is this: are there really solid reasons for the widespread increases in indices and popular stocks around the world during this first quarter of the year? Many economies are still verging on recession. I'm concerned that AI fervor around the big seven, the magnificent seven, I think they're referring to, is causing a bull market that can't be sustained. So is it all built on sand?
Well, I don't think it is built on sand. And I think the reason I say that is that it's true that the market has been driven for much of last year, was driven by this small handful of big growth stocks in the US, the Magnificent Seven. Actually, it's not just in the US. In other markets too, there's been this focus on big growth companies. It's the same in Japan, yeah. Same in Europe as well. It's been quite a narrowly focused. The leadership of the market has been pretty narrow. What's interesting so far this year is that the market is finally beginning to broaden out. The rally is broadening out. So we are seeing, we've talked about this in the past, this equal weighted version of the S&P 500. And it was really lagging behind the top seven or top 10 stocks. But it's now really catching up. And actually since the market bottomed, it's up about 36%, this equal weighted index. Now, that's not quite as good as the 50% or so rise that we've seen in the market capitalization weighted index, but it's definitely catching up. And that for me is a good sign. It suggests that not only are things broadening out in terms of the US market, but they're broadening out more globally as well. So we're seeing markets around the world starting to hit new highs. The Japanese market's doing really well. European shares have done pretty well. Even the UK, which has been out of favour for a long time, is beginning to pick up now. I think we broke through 8,000 this week for the first time.
Yeah, indeed. And this point around the Magnificent Seven and the market concentration that we're seeing, and people have spoken, we've been answering questions on a video talking about an AI bubble. I just don't see that trend, that tech AI trend, as being bubble-like, really. You can obviously look at the valuations on some of these companies and say they're very, very high. But is AI a real thing? Yes, it is. Will it be transformative in some ways? Yes, but we don't know exactly how. Mm. I think the point is, it may not turn into what the market thinks it's going to turn into, and it may be a disappointment overall. But it's going to take a long time to work that out. You're not going to suddenly overnight, oh, right, AI doesn't work as an industry. You know, it's not going to happen like that. It's going to be certain companies, you know, NVIDIA is an obvious one. The valuation is so high, it could easily disappoint from here in terms of the money it earns and the markets it can break and all the rest of it. That it can definitely disappoint, but it will take time for a kind of complete popping of that bubble, if that's what it is. So I'm less worried about that. Secondly, markets are at highs with interest rates being high. You know, it hasn't required interest rates to fall for markets to break new ground. So that's another potential, you know, good starting base for markets to continue going upwards. I don't know if they will or not. I just don't quite buy into this, you know, the catastrophe is around the corner sort of feeling that some investors have.
Yeah, it doesn't feel anything like the dot-com bubble, where really there were a lot of companies on ridiculously high valuations with no fundamental underpinning. It was an illusion back then in many cases. Yeah. What we're seeing this time around is genuinely strong earnings growth from some companies. And in fact, more broadly, what we're seeing is earnings are being delivered. Earnings growth is forecast to accelerate through this year, until by the end of the year, we're growing earnings at a double-digit rate. Set against that, valuations are high, but they are not excessively high. And in many markets around the world, they're not high at all. There are some markets like the UK, like Japan, like Europe, like China, which are really actually quite cheap by historic valuations. So, you know, history never repeats itself completely, but this does feel very different from that bubble of 25 years ago.
Okay, well, let's move on now, Tom. The next question is this. There's plenty of evidence, the questioner says, that in the mid and long term, that most active fund managers fail to outperform their benchmark index. Would you agree that investors should focus most of their assets on passive funds? Would you agree with that?
I wouldn't agree completely. I think that I think there's a role for passive investments. You know, they are a low cost way of gaining exposure to a market, and that has a place in a portfolio. I think when active management works, it works really well. I think that, you know, there are some managers who genuinely have skill in finding attractive investments, and over time, that difference, even if it's quite a small difference of, you know, just a couple of percentage points a year, rolled up year after year for 10, 20 years, can make an absolutely enormous difference. So I think investors are right to try and identify those skillful managers and to put at least a proportion of their investments with those managers.
Yeah, and you know, they've asked should investors focus most of their assets on passive funds. Some of them should, you know. So if you're that kind of investor, I've been that kind of investor, I think, you know, for long periods, where you just want to capture what the market is doing, and you don't want to lose out because of decisions that you've made to, you know, to back one active fund or individual stock or whatever it is. But that's changed in my case somewhat, and it changes for other people. Some people just want that chance of beating the market. And it almost stands to reason that most active funds will underperform the market. You know, absolutely everything being equal, half would outperform, half would underperform. But there are higher charges on active, so more are likely to underperform. But I know what he means. You know, I've seen those those statistics as well in terms of active fund management, it's hard. And it's really hard in an environment like we've had where, as we've been discussing, the gains have been come from a very, very small group of companies. If you don't hold them, you've got no chance of beating the market. And if you do hold them, you're going to basically replicate the market. And that's not what active is there to do.
Yeah, and I don't think that that anyone should think that the kind of market that we've had in recent years is the norm. It's an unusual market. It's an unusually narrowly focused market, and it has been practically impossible for any active manager to keep up with that because the gains have been so skewed to one small subset of companies. So I don't think that you should assume that situation would continue into the future.
Okay, well, let's move on, Tom. The next question is around how you treat losing investments. And the question is this: I have a number of shares which are seriously below purchase cost and look to be staying there. Most are from the pandemic era or before. Time will likely erase those losses to a degree, but in the meantime, I have a lot of cash not actually earning me anything. I really don't know if I'm best to cut my losses and capitalize on these now in the hope of better investments in the future with something else. Do you have any suggestions to aid my decision making? Around 20% of my portfolio is in loss at this time. So they have... Actually, 20% of your investments, which are losing investments, suggest 80% are winning investments,
yeah.
Which is pretty good.
That's a pretty good balance actually between winners and losers. There isn't a simple cookie cutter answer to this question. The reality is that each individual investment you need to make a decision on based on the facts available to you at the time. So you need to look at it at an investment, say, you know, is its valuation incorrect in your opinion, or is it correct? The questioner said, you know, it looks like they're going to stay there. Well, they're already making that judgment. So I think you need to do some analysis and say, you know, what is the correct valuation for this? You know, is the correct valuation significantly higher than where they stand at the moment? In which case, I would not suggest selling them. If you do the valuation and you think, well, actually, maybe that's a reasonable price, you know, then maybe put the money to work somewhere else.
Yeah, I had to chop this question down a bit, so they did have a bit more detail on the specific stocks actually that they were the holding. And it was interesting, one of them, for example, was Just Eat. That's a delivery company. I think they bought it around the time of the pandemic, and I imagine had done very well in the sort of the period following the pandemic. But then cost of living crisis, recession, people aren't spending money on those kind of discretionary purchases in quite the same way. And so the story would have changed, and you need to kind of understand the context for each.
Well, that's a really good example. I mean, I don't know enough about Just Eat to comment specifically on that company, but it's a good example of a share where the story has clearly changed in the last three years. The way that we lead our lives, the cost of living crisis that you referred to, the story has changed, and so therefore it's entirely possible that the correct price for that share is less than the price that this person paid for three years ago. So I mean, I don't know, but it's a really good example of that.
Yeah, okay, well, let's move on for now, Tom. The next question is, I'm looking for a fairly safe long-term investment for a junior ISA. I'm thinking initially of the HSBC World Dynamic Fund for one third of it, but I'm puzzling where to put the remainder. I will, God willing, be investing for my grandchild each year for the next 17 years. I'm going to say they've name-checked this HSBC World Dynamic Fund. I looked it up. Good fund. Looks good. It's been around for 12 years. Highly rated. Outperformed. And is actively managed, but with a charge of 0.66%. What's your assessment there?
Well, I mean, I think investing in a globally focused fund for a child is a good idea. You know, we're talking about investing over a 20-year time horizon by the sounds of it. He said 17 years. You know, it's a long investment horizon. We don't know what's going to happen in 2 years time, let alone 17 years time. The world is going to look very different in 17 years time. So actually, I think covering all of your bases, having a global remit is a good idea. You mentioned the cost of that fund. I mean, I think that, you know, investing over a long period of time, costs can actually have a seriously detrimental impact on the total outcome over a long time, compounded up over time. So there is an argument for minimizing that cost. And of course, the way to do that would be to invest in a tracker fund, a cheap tracker fund. I mean, the problem with a global tracker fund, as we've discussed before, is that inadvertently, you know, you are making a big bet on the shape of markets today. So you buy a global tracker fund, you're making a big bet on technology and probably AI.
You are.
You know, we don't know what the future is going to hold. So I just think as broad-based an approach as possible at as low a cost as possible.
I mean, this is the point I was going to make about the question. I mean, global tick, equities, 100% equities, mm-hmm. tick.
Yep.
And that fund looks like a really good choice. Honestly, it does. Yep. So they're great, but it's the cost. As you know, over 17 years, that's a long time horizon. The costs will really add up. And I actually ran some numbers. I think you can now put £9,000 in a junior ISA. Mm. And the difference that cost makes, say you were able to cut your cost from 0.66 to say 0.16, which mm-hmm. would be a very cheap tracker. That's going to be sort of £13,000-£14,000 of difference over that period with, I don't know, 6% growth or something. So it's significant. It's not going to be all of your invested money, but it's going to be a chunk of it. And you know, you might just want to, if your part of this is to be the doting grandparent, just giving money over and just set up an investment and not really touch it again, probably a tracker is where you want to go, because then you don't have to make a judgment about the best active fund. Even if this looks like a good choice, you don't want to have to be doing that every year or 2 years or what have you. So I think basically passive feels like a good way to go, but otherwise they're along the right lines.
I think they're on the right lines. The one thing I would suggest is just having a bit of introduce a bit of diversification into that. So for example, I'll give you a good example of how we have done this with my fund picks this year. I had two global equity funds, one of which is just a global tracker. It's the League and General Global Equity Index Fund, very heavily weighted towards US technology stocks. Mm-hmm. The other fund was the Fidelity Global Dividend Fund, which is also a global equity fund, but could not be more different because of its equity income characteristics. It's heavily exposed to mainly European dividend paying stocks, big stocks, but not in technology. So actually holding the two together over the long haul would probably give you a bit of a smoother ride, would make you less of a hostage to fortune in terms of the continuation or not of that technology story.
Okay, fair enough. Well, let's move on for now, Tom. The next question is this: is China due for a period of stagnation similar to what we've seen with Japan? I thought it was an interesting question, because sentiment around those two markets has shifted, hasn't it, quite a lot in the last year or two.
It's shifted very significantly, yes. I mean, the Japanese market is flavour of the month after years of being completely out of favour. Recently exceeded its 1989 peak after 34 years. It finally got back above water, and it's on a roll, and everything seems to be going well in Japan. But there was a long period of time when that was the story about Japan. It was stagnating. It had very poor demographics, an aging population. It had overinvested in the boom years, and ended up in a deflationary slump, which lasted for many years. And the way people talk about China is in similar terms. There's a demographic problem in China. There were also political differences in China. A lot of overinvestment. There's a property bubble, which is deflating, which is exactly what happened 30 years ago in Japan. So there are similarities. And the difference, of course, is that the Japanese market started that period very highly, extremely highly valued.
Yeah.
The Chinese market at the moment is extremely undervalued, arguably. It's certainly certainly cheap on any normal measure, price to earnings measure. So, you know, even if the Chinese economy does face some headwinds, which it clearly does at the moment, then a lot of that seems to be priced in.
Yeah, I mean, China is fascinating, isn't it? Because it's got sort of, you know, potentially younger, more up and coming markets slapping at its heels. India probably primarily amongst those. And in terms of the competition for investors' attention, maybe it's lost some of its sheen as the kind of thrusting, you know, newly dominant market in the world. But as you say, it is attractive on a value basis. It's difficult to know what kind of proportion China should take up in a portfolio, because you can kind of look at it in different ways.
Yes, and the question is more about the economy than the stock market. And, you know, and I think that there are, you know, demographic challenges which are a consequence of the one child policy in China. You know, there was the default in China was to invest heavily in infrastructure and in property to keep the economy growing. And the Chinese authorities are trying to rebalance the Chinese economy away from that investment-led and export-led approach to more of a domestic consumption-led economy. And there's a question mark over whether they will succeed. And the big question that people always ask is, will China ever get rich? Or, you know, or the way it's phrased sometimes is, will China get old before it gets rich?
Yeah.
And that is the big question, because Japan, of course, got old, but it had already got rich. It was, you know, it was one of the world's richest countries when it entered its period of stagnation and slump. China isn't there yet. Mm-hmm. So they're not directly comparable.
Okay, well, let's move on for now, Tom, to something completely different. It is this. I'm starting to think about pensions and annuities as I'm already less than 10 years before the official retirement age. With annuities, is there a best time to purchase? Or can it make sense to wait, if possible, until conditions improve? So annuities.
So with an annuity, you know, you're essentially giving up a lump of capital in exchange for a guaranteed income for the rest of your life. So the way that works, just arithmetically, is the longer you leave that decision, the more income the insurance company is going to be prepared to give you. Yeah. So in a way, the answer to the question is, you know, is
it, any weight is a good weight.
Yeah, because you're going to increase the amount. The other thing, of course, that determines how much income you get is where interest rates are at the time. So when interest rates were very low, then annuity rates were very poor. Mm-hmm. And so as interest rates have risen and bond yields have risen, the arithmetic is getting better. But I think the most important thing is to make the decision, do I need to do this now? This person sounds like they're some way off retirement yet.
Yeah.
I mean, when I think about annuities, it's not something that I would think about.
Even in retirement?
Even in retirement, I would leave it. And I certainly wouldn't annuitize all of my income. So I think there are lots of different questions to ask, but basically the longer you can leave it, the better, I'd say.
Yeah, because the insurance companies figures you're going to live for less long, so that's less of a burden for them, so they can make you a better offer, essentially. Also, not a nice thing to think about, but if you leave it longer before purchasing an annuity, there's a higher chance that health conditions will worsen for you. That can also lead to a better rate in terms of annuity income as well.
Yeah.
Not our deal if that happens, obviously, but it can do. So it does make sense to wait. And these kind of decisions, it really highlights the benefit of professional advice around this topic, because I've seen up close the process for advising people in this situation of where their income is going to come from, what's the most tax efficient way of getting an income and a maximized income. And truth be told, it's a mix of, you know, if you're lucky enough to have some pension assets, assets outside of pensions in ISAs or what have you, different company pensions, it's a real skill job in mixing all these things and timing things like the purchase of an annuity to give your, you know, to maximize things and to take into account the fact that you probably don't need, as you get very old, you don't need the income that you might want when you're, I don't know, in your 60s still, or even 70s, and very active and wanting to spend money, wanting to travel and all the rest of it. That a lot of those costs do fall away. So you shouldn't assume that you're going to just have the same income from 65 until, you know, 90, whatever. Mm. You know, you have to be more tactical in it. And a lot of that creates risks for people and a lot of responsibility for their own financial planning. Mm. But it does highlight the benefits of professional help.
Well, they do, because, I mean, you know, what's happened in more recent years is that the responsibility for making those decisions has fallen on the individual much more than it did when people had final salary pensions, and essentially they were given an income. They just weren't working for it. They were still getting an income for the rest of their lives. Things were much simpler then. And I think that you're right, it's extremely complicated. And for people who work in this area, it's very complicated and we just don't understand it. And I think, you know, you can't overstate the importance of getting good advice at the right time.
Okay. Well, let's move on, Tom, because I want to finish off, get a few more in before we finish today. The next question is, what type of bond fund do you expect to do best as interest rates reduce this year? Should I sell an inflation-linked bond fund, which has made quite a loss, now that inflation has fallen, or would it be expected to pick up along with other bond funds as interest rates fall? I'm going to confess, I find this very complicated to work out the difference between different bonds, maturities, etc. It's a hard task for investors.
Yeah, it is a hard task. I mean, broadly speaking, you know, the longer the maturity of the bonds that you hold, the more
sensitive
they are to movements in interest rates. So if you expect interest rates to fall, then you would probably want to hold longer dated, longer maturity, longer duration bonds than shorter ones. So that's a broad brush statement, but it is complicated. They also mentioned inflation linked bonds, and I think many people just assume that, you know, an inflation linked bond is going to protect them from inflation. The reality is that an inflation linked bond is a bond, and so it is impacted by movements in interest rates just as well. So that's why I think people were rather surprised that they lost money when interest rates went up, but that's because it is, you know, nevertheless a bond.
There was something I didn't have. I'm one of these people that misunderstood this, but I think that maybe the capital value appreciates with inflation, but not the income or something. Anyway, but as you say, people assume there would be inflation proofing in an inflation linked bond, but it didn't work like that,
and they were caught out when interest rates rose very quickly in 22.
Yeah, it did, but broadly speaking, falls in interest will be good for fixed income investments like bonds.
Yeah, they absolutely will. But again, there are different types of bonds. There are government bonds, there are corporate bonds, and you know, the valuation of those is different at the moment. So for example, corporate bonds are, because the economy is pretty strong, people are more relaxed than they were about the possibility of companies defaulting. So therefore they are demanding less of a premium in terms of yield on those corporate bonds. So the spreads between corporate bond yields and government bond yields are pretty tight at the moment. So I think they look a bit more vulnerable than the government bonds. So in broad terms, if you expect interest rates to fall, I'd stick with government bonds, and I'd stick with longer dated government bonds.
Okay, well, let's move on, Tom, for now. The penultimate question today. I'm a long-time investor on the Fidelity platform. My question is, it is noticeable that a larger number of companies have taken to share buybacks over the past 12 months in particular. Apart from the obvious intention of boosting their share price, are there hidden reasons why it might be beneficial for them to buy their own shares rather than to take the more direct route of paying out dividends instead? Dividends versus buybacks probably requires something of an explanation of buybacks in particular.
Yeah, so I mean, essentially, what a buyback does is that it reduces the number of shares in issue. So therefore, arithmetically, it increases the earnings per share because there are fewer shares. So it's a way of boosting the share price of a company because the earnings per share are arithmetically increased.
You buy back shares and suddenly your PE looks better, your earnings per share looks better. It's just a mathematical effect, isn't it? So it's just sort of the company, which hasn't changed, is suddenly owned by fewer shareholders.
Fewer number of chunks.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of companies do it. I mean, Barclays, I think, for example, has just recently announced a £10 billion share buyback. So a very significant reduction in its capital base, which will enhance earnings per share and presumably the share price. That's why they're doing it. I mean, a lot of managements like to do it because they are incentivized by share schemes. So it's to their benefit to boost the value of the shares, rather than just paying a higher dividend to everyone else,
and not just because they might own those shares, but because their job might be a KPI of their job might be to increase the share price, unreasonably,
right.
And in terms of that comparison between, you know, basically a company has a chunk of money, they can buy back shares if they want, or they can pay it out as a dividend. One of the reasons they might buy back shares is if they think their company is unfairly valued at the moment or too lowly valued, and they'll think, well, this represents much better value to do this because we'll get a much bigger bang for our buck when the valuation is low. And obviously, in the UK stock market right now, there's a lot of candidates for that, right? They'll see it as good value.
And we're seeing that a lot at the moment in the UK market. I think there are couple of indications that the UK market might be undervalued. One is an increase in the number of and the volume of share buybacks. That's one thing. And the other thing is the high number of takeovers of UK companies at significant premiums to the pre-bid price. So yeah, they're both indications that the UK market might be underpriced.
Okay, all right. Well, let's move on to the last question today. This is strange for us, Tom. We've just come from recording a video where we answered basically the same question. So we're going to be sort of redoing this question, but it's one that we were asked many, many times in the questions. And it is this: have markets factored in the dynamics of changes in policy resulting from a Labour election victory later this year? So have markets factored that in? Do they need to factor it in?
Well, they need to think about it because the polls are suggesting that it's extremely likely that it will happen. I mean, I think it's one thing thinking that there may well be a change in government. It's quite another thing really knowing what the policy implications of that will be, because we haven't even got to the manifesto stage yet. And unsurprisingly, both sides, but particularly the Labour side, are being very cautious about what they say they're going to do, because no one wants to be a hostage to fortune this early in the process. I don't think the market is particularly fazed by the prospect of change. I mean, if you look at the last 8 years or so in the UK, there's been a high degree of political uncertainty. Change is not in and of itself a concern, because the status quo is not stable. So change may or may not be a good thing. I think the other factor to bear in mind is that, when a new government when a new party comes into government after a long period of opposition, I think they're not looking at just a one term in office. They're playing a longer term game than that. And so the first term after a change of government, you know, doesn't necessarily lead to radical change, because especially when it's a Labour government, to be honest, they are conscious of accusations of in the past
being too radical.
Yeah, being too radical. And I think that they're more likely to be actually, I think that a Labour government is probably likely to be less radical than than a Conservative government,
maybe
ironically.
But, yeah, because they need to win an election and they need to address the fact that some people will be spooked by a left-wing government. I think the point you make around stability and instability, or certainty and uncertainty, that's what markets probably care about, isn't it? More than left versus right, Labour versus Tory, whatever. We have had a period of instability in all sorts of ways, changing prime ministers, changing cabinets, and a lot of industries are dependent on political decisions and will need sort of consistency from political leaders in order to have the confidence to invest and what have you. I think a government coming in that suddenly looks nice and stable. I mean, governments have had majorities, parliamentary majorities to work with in the past few years, but they've still contrived to be incredibly unstable as well. You would think that a big Labour, any big win for any party would mean that there should be more stability than we have now. We're not talking about a very radical left-wing government, are we? Let's face it, it's hyper-cautious. Mm-hmm. And I think even when manifestos come out, probably there'll be lots of sticking to existing plans, existing spending and tax plans. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's much for investors to worry about on this side of the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. As regards an election.
Possibly more so on the other side of the Atlantic. And I think the stakes are greater over there, you know, in terms of, you know, the consequences of who ends up in the White House could have a significance on a global scale in terms of relationships with China, for example.
Ukraine, Russia, Ukraine, all of that.
All of that. Yeah. What's happening in the Middle East, all of those things will be influenced by the election in November in the US a great deal more, actually, than what happens when we have our election here.
Okay. Well, Tom, look, we've answered absolutely loads of questions there. I'm afraid that is all the time we have for now. Thanks to you for coming in to answer them today. I will remind listeners that the Investment Outlook itself is available to read at the Markets and Insights section at fidelity.co.uk. There's also videos recorded by Tom explaining his view of the market right now. And there's that Q&A video where Tom and I answer even more of your questions. That is it for now. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week.
Please note that the value of investments and the income from them can go down as well as up, so you may get back less than you invest. Investors should note that the views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon. This information is not a personal recommendation for any particular investment. If you are unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to one of Fidelity's advisors or an authorised financial advisor of your choice. Overseas investments will be affected by movements in currency exchange rates, and investments in emerging markets can be more volatile than other more developed markets. Reference to the specific securities should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities and is included for the purposes of illustration only. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and all tax rules may change in the future. Withdrawals from a pension product may not be possible until you reach age 55, 57 from 2028. This podcast may not be reproduced or circulated without prior permission. No statements or representations made in this podcast are legally binding on Fidelity or the recipient. This podcast is meant only for UK residents and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation in any jurisdiction in which it may be unlawful to make such an offer or solicitation.